BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. In this edition, India's COVID disaster. How did it come about and how can it be ended? In February, India's governing party, the BJP, passed a resolution which declared that India had defeated COVID under the visionary leadership of Prime Minister Narendra Modi. 2 months on, as the country runs out of wood to fuel the funeral pyres, it's COVID that is winning. So what's gone wrong? And what does India's experience tell the rest of the world about what is yet to come? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. It's been a terrible last few days in India. Here's my briefing room colleague, Paul Moss.
It's become almost the soundtrack to life in India these past few weeks, from Kashmir in the Himalayas to the tropical southern capital of Chennai, and in towns, cities and villages all along the 2,000 miles in between, people are in desperate need of medical help. This was New Delhi, the country's capital, where hospital facilities are better than in most parts of India. But even here, ambulances disgorged patients, only for them to find there were no beds free, no doctors on hand, no equipment available to give them the treatment they need.
My father is in a very critical condition. I'm getting no help. Nobody is responding. Numbers are not reachable. Please help me, please. Yesterday I lost my younger brother.
In the northern city of Ghaziabad, a local news crew found one elderly woman being given cardiac resuscitation treatment in the back of a car. Ghaziabad has been held up as an example of the new India, a fast-growing industrial hub with one of the biggest power generation projects in the world. But here and in other highly developed urban centres, citizens are now dying for want of the most basic medical care.
Since morning we are calling people, trying for oxygen and everything, but nobody is responding. And since my mother is ill and I have been panicked since so long.
Oxygen has become India's most precious and sought-after commodity. These sirens are not for an ambulance, but to clear the road as a convoy of delivery vans drive oxygen tanks through a busy town centre. Oxygen tanks are now being supplied by charities and through temples. Civil society has always been strong in India, and the present crisis has seen NGOs, individuals, even the media attempting to fill in where public services have ground to a halt. Sweta Dash is a freelance journalist in the eastern state of Odisha, overwhelmed by requests to use her connections for those who have no one else to turn to.
When I receive a request from a patient's family, crying that, hey, can you please help me with finding leads for a hospital or oxygen or something, and that person is crying, I'm not equipped to deal with that. This crisis of heartache and loss and mourning and grief.
While individuals may feel ill-equipped for this catastrophe, India's government stands accused of being completely unprepared. Indeed, its stance on COVID served to quell preparations which others might have made, according to Zarir Udwadia, a hospital doctor working in Mumbai.
This virus has a country of 1.4 billion firmly in a stranglehold, and it's really exposed our threadbare healthcare system and our failure of leadership, hasn't it? I see younger patients afflicted. I've lost two 35-year-olds, husband and wife, a day ago. But we're in the mess we are just now because of complacency. We let down our collective guard and we were urged to by our leaders. Instead of being asked to be vigilant, we heard self-congratulatory declarations of victory.
It's the thousands of burning funeral pyres, which perhaps tell most vividly the story of India's coronavirus outbreak. Indeed, there are now two resources in demand. Not only oxygen to keep people alive, but also the wood needed to burn the bodies of the dead. Volunteers are having to help keep cremation going, among them Jatinder Singh Shanti, who saw in the flames a sign that the country's death toll was being understated.
"50% of deaths are not registered by the government as COVID-19. Our NGO brings bodies to be cremated directly from homes of victims. The government only counts related deaths of victims who die in a hospital.
Assistance is now starting to arrive from around the world. Britain is sending 120 ventilators, a drop in the ocean, some have said. But then what if it was 1,200 ventilators or 12,000? More than 2 million people have caught COVID over the past week in India, an ocean of suffering which, right now, seems almost impossible to mitigate, let alone bring to an end.
Paul Moss on the Here and Now. But how did it come to this, and so quickly? Joining me is Jyotsna Singh, who writes for the Financial Times. She's in Delhi. Jyotsna Singh, last year, India locked down at great cost during the spring because it understood the coronavirus to be a threat. And then there's been this significant change. Why did that happen?
It is fair to say that the government seemed to have taken the first wave of coronavirus much more seriously. A group of scientists were continuously advising the government, and the government was very careful and cautious in whatever it was doing. It was also able to enforce discipline on its 1.4 billion population, and people generally abided by the lockdown restrictions.
What I'm asking really is whether or not the medical advice to the government changed between last year and this year.
There was an impression that the government had basically stopped listening to the medical advice. The public, as well as the political leadership, had become very complacent because of the fatigue of almost 1 year of lockdown, just started going out. Everybody thought that the worst of the pandemic was over. The case numbers were coming down rapidly. Most people had not held big weddings. Indians are very interested in, you know, organizing big weddings. So for 1 year, all that had stopped. The minute the country opened up, everybody was just trying to do whatever they had not done for a year. They started going out. There were big religious functions. There were big parties. There were big weddings. And at the same time, there were a string of state and local elections that were scheduled to happen across many states. And the prime minister then, and not just the Bharatiya Janata Party leadership, but other political parties as well, started holding big election rallies.
Essentially, the whole of the Indian political establishment acted as though the pandemic was over.
Yes, indeed. In fact, the political leadership had started reveling in celebrations that India had tackled the crisis very well. The Prime Minister told the World Economic Forum that the country had managed to keep the death rate lower than the rich countries. In terms of the proportion of the population, the infection had not spread very widely. So everybody was patting their backs for doing very well. And in fact, even the scientific advice that was coming, it was not very clear whether anybody, whether in the scientists' advisory body or the administration, were actually thinking about what the next wave could look like. In fact, today in an interview in the Indian Express newspaper, the government's scientific advisor has actually said that it is very clear that nobody was prepared for the ferocity of the second wave that we are witnessing at the moment.
Right. So a lot of blame has been placed at the door of the government and its holding of election rallies and its claiming that things were over. But what you're suggesting is that actually this was a wider complacency that had become active within the country and not just within political parties, but within the scientific establishment to an extent as well.
Yes, it seems everybody was almost certain that the worst of the pandemic was already behind them. Everybody had taken their eyes off the ball. While there was some messaging that, you know, people must be disciplined, in fact, Prime Minister Narendra Modi, when the cases started going up again in March and April during the second wave, in a televised address to the nation, actually said that people must be disciplined, people must wear the mask, people must not go out unless they have to. But everybody was asking, you know, the leadership has to follow by example. If you are holding big political rallies, there's very little for the people to see that they have anything to worry about.
Could you tell us what kind of public healthcare system India has?
India's public healthcare is broken. In the 1990s, when India began liberalizing its economy, the private health sector was given prominence, and a thriving private health sector had come into the country where, you know, the world-class facilities were created. But it was a system that could cater to the rich in the country, and the government started promoting medical tourism. That also meant that the majority of the poor got totally left behind. India is one of the least spending countries on healthcare. It is, in fact, just above sub-Saharan countries and Pakistan and Nepal. A majority of the people cannot afford expensive private healthcare. And minimal spending on healthcare has meant that there is absolutely no health infrastructure that can cater to a country of 1.4 billion people. So even at normal times, India's healthcare facilities are overstretched. So when the pandemic happened, there was a lot of talk of what could be done to bolster the healthcare. But all that remained on paper. The government then had decided it would put in place more than 100 oxygen production units, and it would happen in 1 year. But until today, only probably 30 of them have become functional. The rest is still awaited. So when the second wave hit and people started dying because of lack of oxygen, this was one thing that clearly exposed the government's complacency over what it needed to do in terms of preparation.
All the reports that we've seen and heard have been from near hospitals in cities. Is it your impression that actually things might be even worse in areas where people simply aren't even getting to hospitals?
Yes, indeed. We are now getting reports that people, because of this completely non-existent health infrastructure in villages, don't even know what has hit them. This was the fear right from the beginning that should this pandemic reach rural areas, it would be a complete disaster. And that's what is unfolding in front of us.
Now, how is the government handling the public health messaging?
The government is already on the defensive. It has started putting pressure on social media, Twitter in particular, to remove tweets that are critical of the government's handling of the situation. The Uttar Pradesh state, the chief minister from the state has actually already said that nobody should say that there is a shortage of oxygen in the state. And he has even threatened to enforce draconian security law. But this is not a question of perception management at the moment. Literally, everybody that you meet has already seen someone or has known someone who has just dropped dead, who has had to go to hospital, who has faced some kind of critical situation, and they are struggling to cope with it. So it is going to be very difficult for the government to clamp down on criticism or stop negative messaging.
Jyotsna Singh. Among the great ironies of the current situation is India's status as one of the world's biggest vaccine producers. Why is this capacity not saving Indians from the pandemic? Joining me now in the briefing room is Vinita Bal. Vinita is an immunologist at the Indian Institute of Science, Education and Research in the western city of Pune. Vinita Bal, India is said to have vaccinated not quite 10% of its population. The figures I've looked at show it's substantially behind Brazil, say, and pretty much at the same kind of level as Thailand. Do Indians regard that as a low proportion?
The proportion of vaccinated is 9-point-something percent or thereabouts. It is certainly a low percentage because it is unlikely to have any impact on the ongoing pandemic for sure. So that is definitely a problem. However, if you look at the timelines that are there, that from mid-January vaccination started in India, it was just next to impossible to cover anything more than what has been done so far. We do not have extensive infrastructure, trained manpower, vaccination centers, and so on, in addition to the availability of vaccine, I would say.
Let's try and separate out those as problems. The first is vaccine availability, which may be one of the constraints. Now, India famously produces a lot of vaccine itself. So why is there an availability constraint?
There are two aspects to it. While Serum Institute, which is the main one which provides vaccine globally, that's the biggest vaccine producer, there was no contract or apparently no dialogue that was initiated with the Serum Institute before January this year. And Serum Institute was already in contract, had promised to supply vaccine doses to many countries outside India. I do not know whether Indian government took it for granted that it is a local manufacturer and hence at any point, if we demand it, they should provide it. So it's bad planning on the part of the government of India for sure. They did not, they knew how many doses we need because they know what the population of this country is. And why did they not get into any kind of negotiation, contract, whatever, last year itself? That's the problem.
Is it also the case that, as with some other places, the government has banked on some vaccines becoming available, which actually are not available yet?
Yes, indeed. There is quote-unquote indigenous vaccine, which is called Covaxin, and it is produced, manufactured by Bharat Biotech. It was considered that it is an indigenous vaccine. And unfortunately, before even first result of their phase 3 clinical trial, they were given emergency authorization in the clinical trial mode. This phrase, emergency authorization in clinical trial mode, is a new phrase for anything that we have heard before. So that should not have been done because the government of India actually set up its own rules, quite often following what FDA has or European Union has as rules. And then flouting those rules like this was completely unethical and going against the rules that the government should follow.
Do you think that the Indian government initially favoured Bharat Biotech because it was seen as an Indian champion company?
Of course it did. Permission was given before actual data on the efficacy of this vaccine was out. And Bharat Biotech's capacity was never matching with that of Serum Institute. Even today, Bharat is managing to produce about 10% or so of as compared to Serum. So in a sense, this is no competition. Most of the people who have been vaccinated with the Oxford vaccine and not by Covaxin, about 10% by Covaxin. So giving so much of emphasis on supporting Bharat is sort of beyond me, but all of that tends to show that Indian government and people in various committees were favoring Bharat Biotech to what Serum was already doing. Because Serum was the only company which had manufacturing license in India. Many of us were highly critical of government's decision.
Let's imagine for a moment that there were sufficient doses of vaccine available. Does India actually have the infrastructure rapidly to vaccinate its population?
No. Simple answer is no. There is shortage of manpower for vaccination. And because the infrastructure is poor, I don't think even if vaccine supply was regular, we would have managed to do vaccination of all adult population without any hitch.
If vaccination is going to be patchy, is going to take a long time, even at best. And if the health service is really struggling at the very best to deal with the COVID pandemic, That leaves you with one major tool, which is lockdown, doesn't it?
No, I don't agree with that. But yes, that is what the governments and powers that be do think. Reason why I think the lockdowns have become necessary is because the serious patients, the number of serious patients has gone up because of this wave where the numbers have increased manyfold in every city. If they haven't increased in one city, they will increase in the near future in that city because it is a wave spreading from here to there. So in that sense, lockdown is going to save a few patients for sure, but it's also going to kill in the long run many people because they become jobless and their whatever status there was of their finances, that goes even down. So many people will die because of lockdown, and certainly a few will survive because of lockdown. So who is going to gain if we are more for the poor people who are also getting infected and are falling sick? I suspect not having a lockdown is a better option than having a lockdown.
Right, which means that we don't have any very good answers to the Indian pandemic as it is now raging.
Certainly not clear answers.
Vinita Bal ending there with a rather bleak assessment. So what about the implications of the Indian catastrophe for the rest of the world? Have, for example, new COVID variants been responsible for what has happened? I'm joined by Dr. Jeff Barrett. He's the director of the COVID-19 Genomics Initiative at the Wellcome Sanger Institute. His outfit has been in the vanguard of international research into how the virus has been changing. Jeff Barrett, as far as we know, is there a new variant at work in India, and is that what's driving the surge of new cases?
Well, there clearly are, in fact, at least two new variants of the virus in India. There's some reasonable evidence that they have both recently increased in frequency there. I think it's difficult to know, because the situation is changing so rapidly, the extent to which these variants are driving the current crisis in India.
As we know, your operation has been sequencing genomes all over the world. Have you managed to sequence the Indian genomes yet?
Well, none directly from samples taken in India, but we have sequenced quite a large number of positive tests from recently returned travelers. And if you look at what those genomes tell you, we see mostly three types of the virus. We actually see some B117, that's actually the UK variant that started here in late last year and has actually been exported to many places in the world. And then we see these two different things, which are both sometimes called the Indian variant. The code names for them are B16171 and B16172. And there, as the similarity of the name suggests, they're related to each other more than some other versions of the virus, but they do have some differences. And we've started to see both of those subtypes appear quite frequently in returning travelers and their immediate contacts in the UK.
Now, as far as we can tell, are those two Indian variants, are they A, more transmissible, and B, might have a worse effect on younger people than the variants that we've been accustomed to so far?
So in terms of transmissibility, there are, broadly speaking, two kinds of evidence we can look at. So one is simply looking at the epidemiology, basically, are these variants growing faster in the places where they're being seen? And the second is about laboratory experiments of the specific mutations these variants carry. In terms of the first, the observation of transmissions, there is relatively little sequence data coming out of India. I can imagine it's very difficult, given the current situation, to maintain that infrastructure. From what we have seen, it seems like these variants are growing quickly, and perhaps they spread more readily than the kind of older original variants from last year that we all had to contend with. My current best estimate would be they're more transmissible than kind of older versions, and it's not clear how they compare in transmissibility to the Kent UK variant. The lab experiments suggest that some of the mutations do help the virus bind to human cells more tightly. Possibly they evade some of the antibodies we make. No one has studied exactly the combination of mutations in these variants yet, and so we'll know more soon. But I think, you know, the lab evidence suggests there probably is more transmissibility. In terms of whether they can get around our immune system, whether that's vaccine or from being previously infected, I think the data's sparser. And finally, in terms of severity of disease, that's actually often the trickiest one to understand, because you have to try to disentangle when the variant is kind of at its most prevalent from what the local healthcare situation is. I think that's one that we really have very little information so far about.
If you can get a surge of infections like this in India, does that mean that we are quite likely to see a similar surge of infections in other places that haven't seen them so far, say sub-Saharan Africa?
I think it's important for countries around the world to be on guard against this virus. Certainly in countries where vaccine coverage is getting pretty high, like the UK, it's easy to think that we're almost out of this. I do think that regardless of exactly which variants are causing the surge in India right now, there's lots of evidence that the virus is evolving in a way that makes it more transmissible, which is not surprising, but it just kind of ups the stakes about the coming months and years, say, because in any country where vaccine coverage is not yet high, there is a risk of things like this happening, I think. And so being able to react as quickly as possible, I think, is really important.
Jeff, I know this is a little bit outside your immediate bailiwick, but in a country like India, where lockdown is so incredibly difficult, where vaccine availability is problematic, where public health ability to deliver that vaccine, should it be available, is poor, where the capacity to actually deal with the cases themselves once they come in is low, there don't seem to be any good answers. And sending a few ventilators over doesn't seem really to match the scale of the problem. But then it's hard to know what does.
Yeah, it's an extremely difficult situation, from what I can tell as an external observer. Vaccines are in some sense the long-term answer, but they take infrastructure to give to people, and that infrastructure is currently busy doing other things. They take time to work. Fundamentally, I think any mechanism to reduce transmission is what's needed to pull out of these terrifying peaks. It's what happened, for example, in the UK at the beginning of January. If a very strict lockdown isn't possible, then I think one has to try to use other interventions as best as possible, universal masking, maintaining distancing. But I recognize that all of those things are difficult in different circumstances in different countries around the world. So it is a very tricky problem without an obvious solution.
Jeff Barrett there, my thanks to him. As for conclusion, well, you heard what I just heard. My thanks also to Paul Moss, Jyotsna Singh and Vinita Bal. We're back at the same time next week. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Kirsty Knight and Paul Moss. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Jasper Corbett. If you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. We tackle, as they say, a wide range of subjects. There's the one about the fragility of the peace settlement in Northern Ireland, and there's the episode about the rise of the Greens in Germany, and how this might just be to the taste of the British government.
Climate change is real, it's happening, but it's not the end of the world. I'm Tom Heap, and in a new podcast from BBC Radio 4, I'll reveal 39 ways to save the planet.
We've got a new material and a new way of putting solar cells together that produces much more power than traditional or existing photovoltaics.
Our brightest brains are developing potent carbon-cutting ideas, and I'll be meeting them from the paddy fields of the Punjab.
The whole plant can flower in here, set seed, and we harvest the seed and do experiments.
To the Siberian permafrost.
There is a much deeper freeze of the permafrost when you're having a bunch of herbivores trampling on the snow. They trample on the snow by just being there and trying to find food.
We made this mess, but we can clean it up.
My biggest dream is actually contributing significantly to stopping climate change.
Subscribe to 39 Ways to Save the Planet on BBC Sounds.